Hello to our loyal listeners and welcome back to another episode of Mise en Scène with Xavier and Alan. As always, we'll be looking at all manner of film and theatre from around the world. Now, remember to like, follow or subscribe to our show on your favourite listening platform, and also check us out and follow us on Facebook or Instagram to get sneak peeks at upcoming episodes and some bonus content. But this week, we're going to be diving into 2012's standout film of the year, Life of Pi. But before we set sail on this journey, let's meet my co-host. Hello, Alan.
Hello to our favourite fans and welcome back to Mise en Scène. Before we tame our Bengal tigers and delve into spiritual meaning, I want to make our usual disclaimer that our podcasts are best relished for those who have watched the movie prior, and as always, spoiler warnings ahead. So this week, Save, we're unpacking a visually stunning 2012 movie, The Life of Pi. With a 2 hour and 7 minute running time, it's directed by Ang Lee. Now, this movie is an adaptation from the book of the same name, which is written by Yann Mattel. The screenplay is done by David McGee, and it stars Suraj Sharma and Irfan Khan, who play the younger and adult Pi respectively, Anush Tandon, Gautam Ballou, Adil Hussein, and Tabu, just to mention a few. So the plot of the movie, our journey begins in the once French-occupied state of Pondicherry in India, where a boy who's named after a French swimming pool, this is the cultivated and soon-to-be sectarian boy, Pasin Amolita Patel, or strategically shortened by himself, to Pi. Now, Pi's parents own a zoo, and due to an erupting political tensions, his father decides to close up and move to Canada. They plan to take some of the animals and sell them in North America, and the voyage to seek new beginnings on board of a Japanese cargo ship. Now, the irony of this situation is that this is an Indian boy with a French name on board a Japanese ship en route to Canada. Unfortunately, they're met with the tides of fate as the ship gets caught up in a storm and for some unknown reason capsizes. After a tumultuous fall, Pi finds himself accompanied by the likes of a zebra, hyena, orangutan, and a Bengal tiger, all stranded on the Pacific Ocean of what the book documents to be 227 days. He has lost his family, alone and now facing death. The story is about how a boy defies all the odds and fights to stay alive while battling his own fate. Saif, what did you think of this movie?
I really love this movie. I loved it when I first saw it in the cinema about 8 years ago. And this was the first time I've watched it since I saw it in the cinema. And I'm really pleased that the film really still held up to me as a standout example of cinema. It's just a film that has such peace and serenity, and the beauty in the introduction lures you into what will be a beautiful anthropomorphic and somewhat totemic film. And I love the fact that this film is sort of a construct of a man's experiences, his imagination, the culmination of his beliefs and his fears, and that this story doesn't try to be anything to you except what you perceive it to be. And that's very unusual in film, and I just think this film executed it so well. It was so aesthetically pleasing, it was brilliantly acted, the story is rich and vibrant, the cinematography is fantastic, the soundtrack is astounding, and it's just one of those rare films that just seems to get it right nearly every time it does something. How about you?
The Life of Pi was such an outstanding film for me. It's been a long time since I've read this book, and I do vaguely remember thinking, if a studio were to pick this up, how on earth are they going to capture the poetic words of Yann Mattel? The triumph of this movie itself is overcoming its own technical challenges while paying homage to the narrative it's trying to convey. And that, to me, is splendid poetic beauty. The narrative aside, there's an overlaying spiritual splendor to this movie, which had me questioning my own beliefs. There are some great themes and quotes, and I'm sure we're going to be unpacking them shortly. But one thing I want to mention is the lead actor that plays Pi, Suraj Sharma. Wow, did he do a stellar job to bring this movie to full circle. He has no prior acting experience, and not only to come into a movie of this caliber, but to do it in a movie where you don't have a supporting cast to feed off. Now, this requires raw talent, and since he doesn't have a process that many experienced actors may have, I think in a movie as cerebral as this, a fresh face was the way to go.
I agree. I think Suraj Sharma did a fantastic job. And to be honest, I didn't actually know that this was his first film credit. I had assumed that he'd done film before because his execution of this was so brilliant. And as you say, he hasn't got a cast to feed off for the most part. This is an actor essentially against green screen. And that is very difficult even for well-versed actors in the industry. And to find out from you right now that this was his first film credit makes it even that much more impressive, and I was already thoroughly impressed.
Absolutely, absolutely. So now let's have a look at the themes of this movie, because there is quite a few. So I want to start with the origins of Pi. And we're given a background and context as to where Pi's name originates from in the movie. But the word Pi conveys a multitude of relevant associations, one of which is looking at the irrationality of it. Pi is used to calculate the distance of a circle, but it has a staggering 31.4 trillion decimal places. Now, this incomprehensibility of this denotes that some realities are often too complicated and convoluted to explain, but it doesn't prove their non-existence. And I think that's the beauty of this film. I believe that this correlation forms Pi as more than just a central character, but as a symbolic on various levels of meaning and allegory of faith and religion.
I think it'd almost go one step further, and this is something I've just sort of thought about when you've been talking about Pi as a mathematical thing, which, as you say, does occur earlier in the film. But it's talking about a circle, and a whole bunch of this film is also, in a way, the circle of life. And I hadn't really thought about that when I was watching the film, but I thought it is actually quite relevant as an element of the themes that build into this film, because ultimately it is talking about life and the fact that it is this sort of spherical nature where it has a beginning and an ending and it starts again. Anyway, so it's just an aside thought.
No, I think that's great, sir, because I think there is a relevance or association with Pi and the golden ratio and the golden ratio in number that I think Dan Brown has discussed in the Da Vinci Code. It's this mathematical or this specific number that reoccurs in nature and biology, and it's 3.14 or 3.142, and there is a lot of association with that. So I think it is fascinating, and I'm gonna let our fans unpack that. Just moving on, there's a great quote that no one knows God until someone introduces us. Now, this is a great quote. What does it mean to you, Save, and do you agree with it?
From the outset, yes, I do agree with it. And I say that coming from an atheistic perspective. I mean, as listeners of our earlier podcast will know, I'm not particularly religious. I don't have a particular grounding in it, but I was brought up in, I guess, a religious society in school and whatnot. But I think it is a fantastic quote because it's sort of saying nobody has a God until somebody knows a God. And I know that's a bit of an extraneous thing to say because we like to believe we may all know God if we go to church and we pray and things like that. But I think really the point of it is that God is an individual experience. And it's not necessarily saying that someone else says, here's the God you should believe in, therefore believe in it. I believe it's more about saying someone else might give you the idea, someone else might inception you, and it doesn't have to be at a subconscious level necessarily, but they do make a point earlier on this film where Pi goes to visit a mosque and he visits a Catholic church and he sort of dabbles in all these different things, but he gets a different perspective from the people in each one. There's a great point where he's having a conversation with the Catholic priest about why things are certain ways and whatnot. And I think it really is that point. It's not that any one person can show us who God is, because you can't be led to God. People can give you a signpost, perhaps, but the experiences of life are what sort of reveals God to us at an individualistic level. And it makes a point, too, of saying that you're in the Hindu belief, there's over 33,000 gods. You can't know all of them. And I think this story really honed in on the fact that through the experiences Pi had, particularly stuck out on a raft for 227 days, it wasn't just about him surviving. It was about him finding himself and, I guess, in a way, finding what he believed in. And some people may call that God.
For me, on a literal level, I have to agree with this quote. You know, we don't know something until we are introduced to it. And that's exactly what you were talking about. But on an emotional sense, we have the ability to feel. And at times, we may not know what that particular emotion means or how to vocalize it. But we can't deny the process. And comparably to God, reason is used to conceptualize things that you don't understand. So, yeah, that's my take on it.
And a big part of this film really is about conceptualizing what isn't understood by Pi himself. I mean, that's a big part of his journey, is about understanding all these things that aren't necessarily tactile. They may not be real in the world, but they're definitely very real in your mind. And it does make an effort in the film to conceptualize and visually show these things that we may not necessarily understand, but we always want to try and get a grasp of.
I think that's a great segue onto what I want to talk about next, which is Richard Parker, the Bengal tiger in the movie. What does he really represent?
For me, it's summed up very early in the film when there's the quote, "When you look in his eyes, you see your own emotions reflected back at you." And for me, that meant that Richard Parker, not the tiger in the zoo, but the tiger on the boat, is Pi. It is his inner feelings, his inner fears, his inner demons, perhaps, if you want to go that far. But for me, I really felt it was the fear that Pi had within himself and the fear that all of us have within ourselves. And fear doesn't necessarily always live with us. Fear is sometimes only there when we have experiences that require fear to be there, because fear isn't always a bad thing, at least in my perception. Fear can motivate us, fear can drive us, fear can get us out of danger. It can serve a lot of beneficial purposes. I mean, at its most raw form, it's the fight or flight response. Essentially, it can come down to fear and what action we take thereafter. So for me, that's really what the tiger represented. There's certainly more to it than that, but I'll let you get a word in. What did you think?
Yeah. So the movie rallies with the spiritual questions of the existence of God and if one should resign to his faith at the times of turmoil. As a viewer, we're privy to more questions about these concepts than answers. At the foundation of this film, it looks like it's dealing with the turmoil and what happens when an individual is pushed to their limits or even when they're facing death. And at the epitome of suffering, or human suffering, an individual begins to question their belief systems and their realities and their moralities. So pertinent to Pi's life, this belief system is one of spiritual significance. And a significant aspect of Pi's faith is the notion that animals, even apex predators like tigers, underneath all that primal instincts, have souls. And this philosophy is tested when he feeds the meat to the tiger. His father bellows that Richard Parker is not your friend. But when Pi is stranded, his faith is tested, and he has to make a decision on whether to abandon it or to embrace it. The tiger is a reflection and a manifestation of his animalistic innate nature. Pi is battling two battles, one of pure physical survival and the other of the existence of his spirituality. Richard Parker as a tiger will go to any extent to stay alive. His only goal is self-sustenance and survival. So we're constantly shown this dichotomy of the battles in Pi's, I guess, subconscious, where we have the spirituality versus survival. And that's pronounced through this allegorical tiger. You know, he has to abandon his diet to eat this fish to stay alive. So the notion of him, in my opinion, taming Richard Parker is him taming that ferociously growing animalistic nature, which is threatening his spiritual side, so he can find balance between the two.
For the benefit of our listeners, just quickly, and I know we'll come to this a little bit later because it is a key part in the film. Do you believe the tiger is actually in the boat with him or not?
That's a great question. I think I don't think so. No, I don't think so.
Okay, because I'm inclined to agree. And again, for our listeners, we will go into this a little bit later. But it is important to know where we're both coming from in this discussion. Otherwise, we're sort of blowing in the wind. Because for me, the scene where Pi tries to tame the tiger's seasickness, you know, Richard Parker's having a tough time of being rocked around in the boat, and he makes a point of using the whistle to signify distress and calm so that they can sort of work together and co-inhabit the space. For me, it was about him taming his own fear. He wasn't taming a tiger. And ultimately, it becomes about him finding his humanity and peace as he tries to save the tiger and coexist with it. And again, it's not because there was a tiger there. I think it's that inner peace that we have to find, that balance between sort of our fear and our calm nature, because we have to coexist with that within ourselves. And for me, that was a really crucial thing. And likewise, you mentioned where he changes his diet to eat the fish, and this is a little bit more extraneous, but he kills the fish in quite a violent manner, and obviously he has to. It's a large fish and he kills it with a hammer, but the color leaves the body. And for me, I believe it was symbolic of the fact that a piece of pie died with it, and that innocence has been lost to his desperation. And likewise, I think this was him still dealing with a piece of who he was on the inside and coming to terms with it and growing as well. Because we can't always live life through rose-tinted glasses and think everything's going to be okay all the time. There will be times when we're scared, when we're fearful, where we're angry, and we have to deal with these other emotions, but we have to balance them with our own inner peace. And I really think that's what the tiger was about more than anything.
I think it's interesting that you mentioned his face changing while he's all the tone and the color of his facial demeanor changing when he's killing the fish. I think that is a very relevant point to his personality. You know, he's a multi-religious boy. He's accepted philosophies of many different world religions, and he's adapted, you know, that they're all one, and he's embracing the philosophies that, you know, that they preach, and which is why he follows this a vegetarian diet. And for him to kill a living being that he believes has a soul is, you're absolutely right, it's like him killing a part of himself. And it's so tragic to see, and Suraj portrays that so beautifully on screen. Now, since we're talking about this, here's a question for you. Are spiritual beliefs an inevitable consequence of evolution?
I'm inclined to say yes. And again, I come to this from an atheistic perspective, because I think we all have to believe in something bigger than ourselves. Now, okay, no, we don't necessarily have to. It's not a law, and I don't know that it's necessarily a rule of nature either. But I believe for the most part, we feel like there has to be something more than us. Now, whether that's a scientist looking at how the universe was created or a religious zealot telling you it's a certain way and that the world has only been around for 1,000 years, you know, at the end of the day, it's two sides of the same coin. You're still looking for something that's greater than our existence. You know, the mere 80 to 100 years that the average person lives, we've always feel like there's got to be more to it. There has to be a reason. And this particularly comes up when tragedies befall us in our lives. We go, oh, you know, why God? And we discussed this in Leviathan, you know, an atheist crying out, why God? It's almost human nature, and maybe part of it's that we've been indoctrinated in it, but I think at a core level, it's almost human programming that there has to be something more to us. There has to be something above us, and that is a spiritual belief, and that some people may call that God, but not everybody, but it can be something that's just bigger than us. There has to be more to the world and to the universe than just us.
So here's a little fun fact for you. A Brandon Ambrosino, who's a writer for the BBC, talks about a neuroscientist, Andrew Newberg, who studies the brain in a light of religious experience, and he spent his career following this hunch, right? And they go on to say that if you contemplate God long enough, something surprisingly happens in your brain. Neural functioning begins to change. We have different circuits become activated while others become deactivated. New dendrites are formed and new synaptic connections are made, and the brain becomes more sensitive to subtle realms of experience. And our perceptions alter. Beliefs begin to change. And if God has meaning for you, then God becomes neurologically real. And I think that's fascinating. So taking what I just said into the context of the movie, is Pi's faith a manifestation of his neural pathways or his core beliefs?
I'd have to say in some ways that is the question of the film.
Yeah.
Because Pi makes a point of saying to the writer early on in the film, essentially, I have a story that will make you believe in God. And the writer says, well, will it? And Pi essentially sort of says, well, you know, that's up to you. It's up to your perception of it. Yeah. You believe what you want to believe. Yeah. So for me, I really don't know. I think for the most part, it was really talking about what Pi already believes, and he's uncovering more of his beliefs as he sort of grows through these trials, I guess. Whether it's a manifestation, if you talk about in terms of a psychosis sort of thing, from, you know, being isolated and, you know, a bit of a mania almost, yes, I guess, you know, the manifestation could be a neural pathway type of thing, but I don't really think that's what you mean.
Yeah, that's fair enough.
So, no, I think for the most part, it's just interpretation of what Pi already believed in his life and was just uncovering more of about himself.
Right. So where I'm coming, the angle that I'm coming from, I know it's very, very scientific based, but as humans, we're guilty of searching for God, or we can be guilty of searching for God when our back's against the wall. So I just wanted to understand that if this is what's happening to Pi when he's on the boat, because his faith is tested at one point when he does see his father feed the goat to the tiger, his faith is broken at that point. And I truly believe that, because I think he can't find normality again. He struggles with life for a bit. And to look at this question in more depth, I found this article that's called Faith in the Time of Crisis by Brian Goodman. And to summarize, he practically says that there are some positive and negative aspects of turning to fate in turmoil. The positives being it encourages them to sort of like reframe events through hopeful lenses. It fosters this sense of connectedness that we feel towards our faith and our beliefs. It cultivates connections through rituals. But the negative side to this is that we can feel punished by God and feeling angry towards a higher power when things don't really go our way. And then we tend to put it all in God's hands and we give up that human element of things. And we just fall into these moral struggles where we're just debating what's going, you know, if it's right or wrong. But he also goes on to say that the benefits of religion are not just exclusive to believers, right? But there are so many religious practices that we implement in our lives now, such as yoga, which comes from Hinduism, a mindful meditation that we've adapted from Buddhism. So agnostics and atheists still implement these aspects in their life without following the doctrinated concepts of religion.
Certainly. And I guess that comes back to the thing I was saying, maybe there is an element of sort of social constructs are wired into us early on that sort of forms that basis for, I guess, religious beliefs in terms of a higher power again, not necessarily God. And that we sometimes default back to that, whether we're agnostic or atheist or a strong religious believer. But I mean, the other side of that too is if you want to look at it from a scientific perspective, there is that sort of argument that I guess everybody has two personalities in a sense, the sort of our inner psyche and the outer projection that we have, and that sometimes they come into conflict. And when they're totally out of whack, you end up with people that are sort of manic and have lots of psychological issues. But I think for the most part, we probably still all have that on the inside. Most of it, us tame it and control it in a more introverted fashion. And I do wonder if sometimes that manifestation of God and our anger and angst against a higher power is sometimes that clash between our two inner monologues, essentially. And they're just not quite lining up to one another. And it blames itself for something that it did, but you're still essentially blaming a part of yourself. And to manifest that is very difficult in oneself. So we project it as a higher being that's outside of our body because that's the only way we can process it. But I mean, that's getting very medically scientific and way down the path, and we're losing the track. So I'll pull up out of that.
Yeah.
But it is interesting.
Yeah, yeah, for sure, for sure. So just based on what you're saying, say, why do you think that Richard Parker didn't turn back in the end?
For me, that was a really poignant moment in the movie. And it said to me that fear leaves us without pomp or circumstance, that it merely ceases to exist once it has served us. And if you look at it as I have, in the sense that the tiger was his fear and that he conquered it and now he was safe, that he no longer had that fear. The fear no longer served him in the sense that it helped him survive. And so once he was in safety, his fear merely left him. It didn't make a big cry. It didn't do anything. It didn't make an acknowledgement. In a sense, fear, if you thought of it as a spirit animal, you know, this totemic creature that lives within all of us, it just sort of leaves. It wanders off, and at points in our lives, it may come back, and it may not always be a tiger. It might come back in some other form. But I think the point is that it never truly leaves us, so it never says goodbye. That might be very cerebral, but that's sort of how I felt about it.
I think I had a slightly different twist, similar, but still a bit different. The movie talks about the whole of life becomes an act of letting go. But what hurts the most is not taking the moments to say goodbye. And this is what you've just mentioned as well. And I think this is essential to what happens in the end of the movie, where Richard Parker does the same thing to Pi. He does the same thing that Pi has endured his whole life. This could simply be Pi projecting his experiences as the final manifestation of Richard Parker. But I think there's more depth to that. The fact that Richard Parker doesn't say goodbye, and if he was a real tiger, it would give credence to what Pi's father was saying all along, that he's merely just an animal. There's no soul to this, you know, to this beast. But I believe that this is once again a test of Pi's faith. He has seen Richard Parker leave him. He has witnessed it, and he gets carried away, but he still believes. You know, he still pursues his faith, and he just simply believes, even after knowing the truth, or what possibly could be the truth.
But in the sense that you talk about, you know, it's an animal instinct, you know, it's this sort of primal thing. I guess fear is one of the most primal things we can feel. It's not a conscious level thing. And I guess that's where I sort of bring in this animalistic spirit is, you know, again, back to that fight or flight. It's not a conscious decision. It's not a higher function. It is that animalistic primal part in us that makes us act in a certain way. So it doesn't need to be about an animal that's external to the person. It's the animal within us.
Speaking of animals, Save, I know you had an interesting theory about the animals on the boat and what they actually mean to you. Do you want to elaborate to our listeners on that?
Sure. So in the film, there's a point where the writer asked Pi in the sort of present time, what was the true story? Was it about the animals or was it about the people? And I had this theory that there may have actually been a third version, which Pi doesn't offer to the writer because it's about an individual's perception. And for me, I thought that the third version might be a version just for Pi, because it's unique to his experiences. And this is where Pi was truly alone, that the animals embodied his emotions and his psyche. There were no other people and there were no animals on the boat. It was just him floating for 227 days. And for me, the tiger represented anger. The zebra represented suffering. The hyena represented panic, and the orangutan represented his loss. And I felt like these would be the emotions and probably some of the core emotions which anybody in that situation would go through. If you've just been lost at sea, your entire family's dead, everything you've known is left behind, and you were just bobbing around on this magnificent blue marble that we call Earth, you couldn't help but feel these things. Anger, suffering, panic, loss, because everybody would feel all those things. They're primal emotions. But for me, Pi couldn't tell that to the writer because, again, they have to be lived. And if you don't live them, you'll never truly understand them. And people might say they understand loss or panic or whatnot because they've had a panic attack in a shopping center. But really, it's different. And everybody feels these things differently. So I just sort of felt like that might have been what Pi actually believed, but that it didn't serve telling anyone else that story because they didn't live it. Just my thought.
Yeah, this is a truly unique thought, and one that hasn't crossed my mind either. But it's definitely valid. You know, I guess some stories are more emotional, you know, than the truth.
And I think that's really the important point of this film, because he's not saying which one is the truth, because it's not important. And it's a bit like the Bible, and he makes a little reference to this. You know, which one would you rather believe? Do you want to believe essentially the fable that tells the same story, or do you want to believe the truth, which is the same story? At the end of the day, you get to the same result, but one is a nicer, more palatable form of getting there. And I think that's essentially like the Bible. It's a nice version of telling history rather than it being the equivalent of a 700-page history book. You get to the same point if you look at it hard enough. And I do sort of wonder if that's sort of where it was getting along the lines of, you know, stories are more emotional than the truth. Because it's true. Yeah. They are. You can tell a truth in a very emotional way. It doesn't have to be dry.
Spot on. So moving on to our final point in the themes is I want to look at the island. The island, in a way, is symbolizing those who surrender themselves to God without unwavering their faith. If there's fresh water, there's a clean place to sleep, unlimited food supply. The island is all Pi needs to survive and live a long and prosperous life. However, we don't know that the island has its own perils. And Akshin Jaku, on his YouTube video, relates this island to the concept of a false salvation. I think this is brilliant. You know, we see at night the water becomes toxic and that the island becomes carnivorous. Akshin goes on to compare that there are many of us that relate to the temporary respite of our voyage with its conclusion. However, concluding your journey at such a false point may end in peril. Our own personal journey only reaches fruition when we reach true salvation. So recognizing true salvation from false salvation is one of the biggest battles one will face in the journey to spiritual enlightenment.
I saw the island very differently to you. I mean, we see a profile shot of the island and it's a prone man. And for me, this suggested that Pi has been laid bare and that he must look inside himself to decide who he wants to be. And that the carnivorous island was symbolic of man's destruction of self. And that the fact that a man can never stop moving and never be alone or else he shall die. And that point for me was really reiterated by the fact that he finds a man's tooth within a carnivorous plant. Now, whether the plant truly was carnivorous or not, I think is irrelevant. Because at the end of the day, I don't think the island was real because, you know, thousands of meerkats I don't think could have survived on this island. But it was really about the fact that Pi needed to get back to reality. And it reminded me in some ways about the red turtle. And when the man was stranded on an island, he had to come to terms with who he was and how life was going to be from here on out with for him. And Pi had to make that decision too. And for me, the fact that he went back to the boat, because Richard Parker went back to the boat, said that fear drove him off the island again, and that he couldn't live without fear, because if you live without fear, you essentially died on this island. And so for him, he had to take his fear with him and keep moving in order to get where he truly needed to be. Sorry, I'm diving deeper than the shipwreck in this film, but I love this film.
No. I think that's a very interesting take. It's something that I haven't considered myself. I did see the shape of the human. I thought it was a woman. I've interpreted it as a woman, and I thought, oh, you know, like the director's trying to say this is Mother Nature as well, you know, and how she can be aggressive and
true. I did wonder too that might have been a woman as well, but then part of me sort of went, maybe it's just Dwayne Johnson with massive pecs. I don't know, but I'm just gonna take it as a man.
Shout out to Dwayne. He didn't pay for this plug, by the way.
No, I just love you, Dwayne.
So I want to get into the cinematography, save. I'm just moving forward. And I think that Ang Lee has a fastidious eye for great metaphors. And he achieves this without compromising the command of the book's dialect. Now, he was able to capture the essence of the book and the original plot and convey it into a visual mastery. With the help of Claudia Miranda, which is the DOP, have done a heavenly job in conjunction with Ang's vision. There are a few magical shots. Even from the start of the film where Pi is being trained by his uncle in the swimming pool, there's an overlay of frames. And this made my brain glitch with excitement because I had to process the imagery on screen in a short amount of time and take in all the serene visual effects. And there is an aspect ratio change as well to a much narrower one after the dream sequence. And a possible indication that, you know, there's not much reality through Pi's eyes anymore. And there are other subtle changes in the aspect ratio when we see the flying fish scene when it becomes a cinematic wide angle. Did you find these changes as well, Sam?
I did. they actually jumped right out at me off the screen. And I don't know if that was the same in the cinematic version. I can't remember if the projection also changed ratio there. I know a lot of films only change ratio in sort of the Blu-ray releases later down the track. For me, it bothered me. And I know I've harped on ad nauseum in previous podcasts about how ratio changes and wrong aspect ratios really annoy me. It did bother me a little bit in this because as an aesthetic thing separate to the film, it kind of kicked me out. And at one point I was like, oh, hang on, did that just letterbox itself? And for me, that was a bit irksome because it took me out of the cinematic world into my own reality and went, something's changed. A bit like, you know, if someone knocks on a doorbell, and that bothered me. But as an artistic thing, if that was deliberate intent for effect and it was in the cinematic version too, I did understand it and I could sort of get this perception that maybe it was trying to tell us something differently. But by the same token, I didn't really feel like it added much benefit to it for me. So I could have quite happily done without it. But as a cinematic piece on the whole, notwithstanding the aspect ratio changes, this is a thoroughly beautiful film. Some of the shots where, as you say, that the frames are blended and they move through each other, and you know, this sort of the negative space is filled with another image and scene. It was fantastically done. And it's not the sort of common effect that's done in a film, but it worked beautifully to convey these sort of dream sequences in this sort of ethereal place in this mystical story. It hit all the right marks for me.
Yeah. Now, we need to mention the CGI animation and the work that went to bring what we saw to fruition. Apparently, there were 4 real tigers that were used along with CGI. I did read that there were 23 real tiger shots that made it into the final cut, and the rest were all CGI. And even with the CGI, Ang Lee spent time with real tiger trainers on a green screen boat to get the mannerisms of movement to make it authentic. And this was later replicated by the CGI company. And it's astounding that there are over 3 million hairs on the CGI tiger that had to be individually processed. And the task itself seems momentous, but the outcome was so beautiful.
It's funny because if you look at CGI stuff now, 3 million hairs really doesn't sound like much anymore. I mean, if you look at the new Lion King, you know, the level of animal photorealism in there is just second to nothing at this point in time. But the tiger 8 years later for CGI effects actually still stood up quite well. And I was quite pleased about that because I was worried that looking at this film 8 years down the road, the CGI would have let it down a little bit. And in all fairness, there was a couple of scenes at the start, particularly one of the elephants was clearly CGI compared to another one in the scene that was clearly real, at least in my perception. That was a little bit disappointing. But it's the sort of thing that I feel like this film is worthy of someone going back into it and going, let's just tweak the CGI a little bit. We've got better processing power, better CGI, better particle effects and whatnot now. Let's just have a tinker with it. And I don't mean going through and tinkering with all the CGI and doing a George Lucas and making a hash of it. I just mean fixing a couple of little things that weren't quite right by today's standards and leaving it alone. Don't fettle with anything else. By the same token, I guess you could argue that, yeah, in another 8 years, it should be better again. So maybe you just leave it alone. But I just felt like this film deserved to have a few little refinements made to the CGI just to keep it fresh, because otherwise it's faultless. And the amount of work that went in to get it right in the first place was astounding.
Yeah. We can't talk about this film without talking about the sound in this movie. And Mikael Danna does a remarkable job with the soundtrack. The film starts with this music that makes the viewer feel comfortable. And I felt like I was in a safe place. The overlay of the South Indian lullaby, which is sung by Bomba Jayashree, is soothing. And you can even hear the accordion in the background, which I presume is done to pay homage to the French influence on Pye's life of Pondicherry, India.
Without a doubt, the music in this film was astounding. And it wasn't necessarily something that jumped out to you, but I don't think music always should. I think music should be one of those things that's built into the film and embodies and encompasses and builds the entire sort of ethereal experience around a film. And I know we've mentioned before in previous films where sound is jarring. You know, it's a wrong selection of music. All the sound effects are out of place. They're just too distinct. But yeah, in this film, again, I think they hit all the right notes. The tones were perfect. The songs were fantastic. They were inviting. It was a bit like walking into a rainforest and just listening to birdsong. It's calming. It's soothing, as you said. It was just a wonderful place to be. And I think even if you didn't watch this film and you just listened to parts of it, it is an experience in itself. And to have pulled that off, Danna did a fantastic job.
Right. Now, to wrap this movie up, guys, The life of Pi inundates us with pictorial poetry, transcendent references, and thought-provoking questions that will even challenge the most pious leaders. The theme and references explored in this film are correlated with deep-rooted attributes of philosophy, of religion, God, and morality, and it even questions the validity of truth and faith. With a superb cast, narrative, and directing, The Life of Pi might just make you believe in the existence of God. And for this reason, I give this film an 8.5 out of 10.
It's funny you mentioned at the end, you know, make you question the validity of truth and faith, because I was almost inspired, and I may still well be, to actually go and read some other religious texts, because I kind of liked Pi's idea of, you know, look at different religions and sort of, I guess, cherry picking the bits you like, because there are good things in lots of different places. And essentially, we're all talking about the same thing. But I digress. It was a fantastic film. It's one of my favorite films. And as I said at the start, I was so glad I saw it again after seeing it in the cinema 8 years ago. And I have to give this film a 9.5.
Oh, close to perfection. Brilliant. I might even have to change it to a 9 out of 10.
I almost considered a 10, but I thought if they just fix the CGI, I'll give it a 10.
Yeah. So what? Why don't you tell our fans what we're listening to next week?
Sure thing. So the next film we're going to be looking at is a Chinese film called A Touch of Sin. It's from 2013 and it focuses on four independent stories set in modern China about random acts of violence. It might be quite a heavy film. We're not sure. Neither of us have seen it before, but we'll continue our little cinematic trip around the world. So until then, remember to like, follow or subscribe to our podcast. Listen to some of our previous episodes in case you've missed any and tune in next week.
Excellent, Zaid. We'll see you guys next week.